Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:08 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is October 22nd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, this is an intraday chart of gold, and it traded almost 4,000 contracts right on the breakout above the 1795 level earlier on today, and then as it traded down through that level, it traded more than 4,000 contracts. So it's basically a signal that everyone who was buying the breakout sold as soon as their stop was hit. And then subsequently the price popped back up again. So it would be easy to think that gold is in fact extraordinarily volatile. But in fact, what we've seen over the course of the last year is a narrowing of trading, and there's been a lot less volatility. So certainly that's a big tail on the candle, right in the region of the trend mean and the sequence of lower rally highs. So it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we might get some additional consolidation. However, I think it's also particularly worth considering that when we think about the medium-term trend, we have an evolving triangular pattern. And these triangular patterns, they generally give way to explosive breakouts. We have a narrowing of trading. So the people who want to sell the rallies are still eager to sell any kind of strength. Those that wish to buy the dips are not waiting as long before they initiate purchases. So we have the sequence of higher reaction lows is generally consistent with demand starting to return, and that people are not willing to wait until it pulls back to the lows before they initiate their longs. But there's still plenty of buyers or plenty of sellers who are willing to sell the rallies. So we can't have a breakout until either we get a vacuum of supply above the market, in other words, that everyone who wants to sell has already sold, or we get a vacuum of demand below the market, in that everyone who wants to buy has already bought. Well, considering that gold hasn't gone anywhere for most of the last 15, 16 months, then it's reasonable to I think, conclude that at least some people have already sold, and that the height of enthusiasm that we saw when prices were cruising through $2,000 has certainly ebbed, and there's a lot more people that are talking about negative consequences, and potentially that gold is going to have another significant big leg down before we get a recovery. So there's still, and I've seen a considerable number of people talking like that over the course of the last 3 weeks, despite the fact that the price has been rising. And that's usually indicative of negative sentiment, that people have become disappointed, that they've been buying breakouts, they've been stopped out, they are feeling disgruntled, and therefore they have a vindictive wish to see prices go down considerably from here in order to provide them with a very attractive buying opportunity, because everybody always wants to buy at last week's prices, particularly when the price has been rising. Of course, we're still also in this odd environment that inflationary pressures have been rising, and yet gold has not really participated. And when we think about that, well, it's a large part is because the dollar has been strong. So one of the weaker currencies all around has been the yen. So gold has broken up and through the 2 million yen level over the course of the last couple of weeks. The Indian rupee, until yesterday, was testing its lows. So it's also broken its sequence of lower rally highs. When then we think about some of the stronger currencies, well, the pound has been among the stronger currencies around, so the price there is still only testing the sequence of lower rally highs. And again, here we have a triangular pattern evolving. So ultimately, we're going to see a breakout, and when that breakout occurs, it's likely to be really emphatic. Baidu is perhaps one of the best examples of these triangular patterns. It was a couple of years ago, but we had this very clear triangular pattern, and it proceeded for really quite a lengthy period of time. And then we got this really very conclusive breakout. Now, it hasn't been a particularly consistent trend since then, but the triangular pattern certainly was evidence that we were getting this narrowing of trading, which would give way to volatility. And I think that is quite likely something that we can anticipate from the gold price. And then, if we want to think about, well, what is the potential, then I think the longer term chart of the purchasing power parity adjusted price of gold is the most interesting. So it hasn't been updated until or for a while, so let's bring that up to date, or at least to the greatest extent possible. So prices are still holding here around the lower side of the range, and if this is a regrouping and nothing more than a medium term pause in the region of the previous peaks, well, then it would suggest that when gold does eventually break out, well, it would take out that peak around the 250 area and then potentially improve upon it considerably. Then we can start thinking about the oil price, because when we think about commodities, when we think about inflation, well, oil plays a pivotal part in that, considering that it is really vital to the global economy, despite the propaganda that's being created with regard to the desire to have a carbon-free global economy. And that's likely to reach fever pitch over the course of the next few weeks because of the big climate conference in the UK. Nevertheless, oil prices continue to trend higher, and they're holding above the $80 area. This, of course, is still in pounds. In dollar terms, it's cruising back towards the peak around the 2018 highs, and it would really need to sustain a move back below the trend mean to really question that we're not still in a demand-dominated environment. I think one of the things that is now starting to gain attention is the quantity of oil sitting in Cushing, because it's down from 60 million barrels, excuse me, 600 million barrels to 300 million, and that's been going down all year. So we've had a lot of wells that have been idled. We've had the shale drillers who have were really chastened by the negative prices last year, and then they've been told by their bankers that they're not going to get any money until they can realistically make a profit. So prices up to around $80, well, that certainly puts them back in the black. And now the big question is whether they can produce enough to ensure that we don't get into a really dire situation. So I think it's, let's just see how much history we have for this. And we can see clearly that down around the 20 level, that would be considered very low. So it's not simply that we have a shortage of gas in Europe, or shortages of gas everywhere, or that thermal coal prices in China are surging higher. So there's been this political adventurism, and then these political wish lists, and the desire of politicians to make a name for themselves and to appeal to the mob who have been calling for the end of fossil fuels without ever really putting into place an alternative. So when they were building wind turbines in the UK and closing down coal-fired power stations, they never considered that the wind would stop blowing. And nobody wants to talk about the the no-brainer, which would be to simply build more nuclear reactors. This argument has been going on for a long time. I remember looking at the evolution of the tar sands in Canada more than a decade ago. It really feels like an awfully long time ago. And considering that all of that oil is sitting there frozen for the vast majority of time, which means that they have to go off and pipe in natural gas, superheat the oil so that it can flow, then mine it, and then try and refine it. So it tends to be a very dirty process of mining very heavy oil and bitumen. And of course, the easy thing to do would be to install a nuclear reactor. But there's absolutely no appetite for that in Alberta, or much of Canada for that matter. So then it's going to continue to be one of the most vilified sectors within the oil market overall. But one thing we can say for sure is that if crude oil data stocks continue to trend lower, well, then that's going to continue to put upward pressure on the price. So we're still in a demand-dominated environment, and we can think about that there will eventually be a supply response, and that the energy companies have got a great incentive to invest the money, but they're in a tight situation, and this is most particularly because of the threat of additional regulation, the potential that there's going to be a federal mandate in the USA for carbon taxes, and that's going to simply increase the price of oil all around. It's all well and good for the UK, or for, excuse me, the EU to introduce carbon taxes because it's not an energy producer to any real extent, and certainly not energy independent. And we've seen that the carbon price has paused over the course of the last few weeks, and they've been attempting to ameliorate the situation in terms of the really chronic undersupply of natural gas. And it is reverting back down towards the mean, despite the fact that it was in positive territory over the last 3 days. But imposing a carbon tax in the US, which is an energy exporter, well, then that's going to push up prices. And we're already in a situation where there is less available supply. And then we can think about natural gas prices. So natural gas has been easing back, having got all the way up towards the $6 level. But then the bigger question is, how far will it fall? Are we going to see a similar big surge in supply like we saw back in 2014 and 15? And the answer is maybe, but there's still likely to be a lot of demand from international markets. And because the USA is now a major gas exporter, well, then that's going to continue to contribute to volume demand growth for the LNG exporters. And that's likely to equalize the price internationally. So it's unlikely that natural gas is going to continue to remain in this very long-term range indefinitely, because we're likely to move much more towards a globally fungible price for natural gas, which was a predictable evolution, but now it does look like it's in fact happening. So when we then think about UK natural gas, well, there was positive overtures from Ukraine offering Russia a discount to pump more volumes through Europe, but the reality is that Russia has Europe exactly where they want them. And natural gas prices have certainly contracted, but we are still miles away from the upper side of the base formation, and prices are still holding around the 200 pound level, but the upper side of the base is more like around 75, so it could still halve and still be holding the breakout. If Russia in fact, agrees to send more gas through to Ukraine, well, or through Ukraine to Europe, well, that might help to bring the price down. But the big question, of course, is why would they do that? They want long-term contracts. Europe doesn't want to sign them. And then Europe is being taught a lesson that if they're going to rely on low prices persisting indefinitely and they wish to absorb the volatility, well, they're going to be provided with ample volatility until they have an appetite to accept long-term pricing again. And you can be sure that those long-term prices, well, the average, even if it's an average over the course of the last decade, we can think that that average price now is at 100, whereas prices previously, well, the average never was quite that high before. So even if Russia were selling average price gas, they'd still be making out like bandits. So this certainly looks like a tight environment for energy overall, and it's likely to continue to contribute to inflationary pressures. Now, when we hear people like Jay Powell talking about inflation and saying that, well, they think that inflation is probably going to persist well into 2022, but and they deem it to be timely to begin tapering, but that they're not eager to raise interest rates. Well, then we can think about the shorter end of the curve, where it's unlikely we're going to have an interest rate hike in the next 3 months, but that yield is pushing up, and it was at zero in September, and it's at 5 basis points now. The 5 year, which is representative of the average maturity of US debt, is also trending higher. And it was in negative territory today. So that I think is rather interesting that yields have been rising in anticipation of the beginning of tapering. And as soon as tapering looks to be more confirmed, we get a steadying. As we push up towards the 1.25 level, we're still at only a fraction of where we were back in late 2018. Of course, in that time, the quantity of debt outstanding has increased substantially. And I think this is one of the challenges that we're seeing bond yields rising everywhere. If we look at the German Bund, it might still be in negative territory, but it is coming up towards that zero bound again. And there's the prospect here that we're going to have a green government enter power, or at least a government where the Green Party has a lot of sway. And then that is setting up this question between the priorities of France and the priorities of Germany, because France has been a champion of nuclear energy and has been largely energy independent because of it. And many people have questioned how is it that France can compete when they have such large debts, when they have this massive socialist economy. How is it that France can maintain these living standards, whereas the UK, with a country or an economy of a similar size, seems to have more difficulty ensuring that the standard of living is the same? And there, I think it is not a it's not a mistake that the UK became a net energy importer in 2004, and a lot of the difficulties that the economy has experienced have occurred since then, because there's simply less available money. So, the response to the credit crisis, then having large numbers of troops overseas, and then a lot of complaints about how well equipped those troops were, And now we're looking at the energy situation and having these extraordinarily high prices and shortages of everything from carbon dioxide to natural gas to fertilizer, and then shopping shelves not full. And one does have to wonder how much of that is to blame because the UK is now sending billions overseas every year because they're no longer energy independent, and what kind of priority shift that's going to create within government. Because that's exactly what's happening everywhere in Europe. They've suddenly begun to realize that they have the opportunity, or at least the potential, to get closer to energy independence. And it's become a priority since the USA has become energy independent. So we're going to continue to see a strong evolution towards renewable energy because it's the answer for the vast majority of Europe. There's going to be a new energy mix because there's the clear effort underway to excise coal from the energy mix and replace it with wind. But natural gas has to form a part of that as well. And then, of course, we have the potential for more nuclear reactors to be constructed. So uranium remains in an uptrend and a broad recovery overall. It was also interesting in here this week that Kazatom announced that they're also going to sell some of their supply to a physically backed fund. And the share continues to push on the upside. So it's been absolutely resurgent over the course of the last couple of weeks and pushed on to a new high in here this week. So, despite the occasional negative headlines that we see with regard to uranium, it looks like it's a bull market. And it's the ultimate solution to the answer of how do you develop or how do you deliver a base load electricity without carbon. Of course, it's also likely to help with the evolution of the hydrogen economy, and there's a lot of efforts underway to develop hydrogen, and a significant number of the shares are firming from the region of the trend mean. But the big question is that when we think about the evolution of hydrogen, well, a lot of these companies are brand new, and they've been around for a long time, and they've been really short of a big rationale for why they should continue to do well. So there's obviously this big trend that countries want to be energy independent, and then we're also looking at a global environment where we have much more tense geopolitical relationships. So countries also want to be energy independent to, I think, insulate themselves from the risk of having commodities being made less available. So that's certainly also, and it's definitely one of the things that China thinks a lot about. So they're building solar complexes, they're putting up wind turbines, they're building nuclear reactors, and they're building pipelines for oil and natural gas from Russia. So Russia's in a rather benign environment. They're raising interest rates right now because of inflationary pressures, even though they expect that inflation will start to moderate next year. And yields there are, at least in the local currency markets, are somewhere around 7%. In the US dollar denominated debt, they're about 3%. But the ruble has been strengthening. Now it's at the first area of potential resistance. The 70 level has been, and it was an area of support all the way from 2015. Now the potential is that it's an area of resistance. So we could see some consolidation around this area, and then the at the RTSI, which is a dollar-denominated index, has come right back up to test the 2000 level. So this is also a potential area of support. But Russia is not a heavily indebted country. They have lots of gold, and they have major commodity exports of just about everything. So as we continue to look at the potential for a global recovery, and certainly that remains underway, well, then there is the potential that commodity producers will continue to do well. And of course, then we're still in a benign environment overall for copper. Now, copper prices have been down over the course of the last couple of days. This chart hasn't been updated. So we've had some consolidation over the last couple of days. We're right in the region of the 450 level. Now, that's where it was the push above 450 broke the sequence of lower rally highs. So we're coming back into an area which should begin to offer support if we're still in a benign environment overall. We had a short-term overbought condition. A lot of it has already been unwound, and there's certainly scope for additional upside. So we're still in this inflationary environment, and we're still in a transitionary phase. And if we're in a new commodity-led bull market, well, we have these shortages of oil, which should help to support the price. But we also have demand growth for copper, and that's a very different environment. We have supply and elasticity meets rising demand for copper, and the increasing potential for doubling down on building more wind turbines is beneficial for copper overall. When we think about the mining sector, well, the really big companies all concentrate on mining iron ore. So that has weighed on the sector as the Chinese demand for iron ore started to contract, but the FTSE 350 mining index is now bouncing following the failed break below the 20,000 level. So right in the region of the trend mean, so there is certainly potential here that we might get a little pause, but as long as it's holding that low, well, then we're still in a demand-dominated environment overall. When we then think about the wider market, well, we are in inflationary, we're in more of an inflationary environment. And there's been a lot of questions about is gold or commodities, are they the best hedge against inflation? Or perhaps is it Bitcoin is the big hedge or the most attractive hedge against inflation? I'm very leery of relying on a brand new asset as a hedge against inflation. Certainly, Bitcoin has a limited supply argument. Now, limited supply works when you have lots of people stockpiling. So, we had the introduction of an ETF this week, and it did phenomenally well. Then we had another ETF launched today and did less well, and prices advanced considerably in advance of the introduction of the ETF, and now they're starting to come back down. There's a lot of people talking about the fact that this is the evolution of ETFs, and the demand that that's creating for futures is going to improve the liquidity of the market, and that ultimately, because of the arbitrage opportunities that we have between the various ETFs, between the futures and the physical or the spot levels, that ultimately, as more of that arbitrage kinds of trading take place, then eventually the inefficiencies in the market will be ironed out and volatility in crypto will deteriorate. Well, certainly that would be a benign outcome. Now, there's the additional point that futures-based ETFs have contangos to deal with and don't have a ready way of managing the contango. So they have a built-in underperformance metric. So that's obviously something that's going to contribute to they underperform when prices fall, and they, excuse me, they fall more when prices fall, and they underperform when prices rise. So they don't really become attractive from a holder's perspective, but they become trading vehicles, and certainly they become much more attractive when there is an opportunity to short. So the price got up to a new all-time high on Wednesday, and now it's coming back down, and we're testing the 60,000 level and approaching the weekend, and Bitcoin trading over weekends tends to be rather volatile. So what happens over this weekend is going to be rather pivotal, because the move above 60, it would be extremely benign if it were to hold. If we see a more dynamic move downwards, well, then we'd be talking about a failed upside break. So certainly it's a rather interesting environment. One of the reasons why I'm rather leery of focusing on Bitcoin as an inflation hedge is it acts like a risk asset. So Tesla has been a lightning rod for investor interest over the last decade, and most particularly over the last year. And it also has pushed on to new high ground and following Bitcoin higher. Now, obviously, there was news about deliveries and that the earnings were doing better, but nonetheless, Bitcoin's also a major holder of Bitcoin. Excuse me, Tesla is also a major holder of Bitcoin. So that's obviously contributing to the price pushing on the upside in here right now. When we then think about the other big inflation hedge, well, it's stocks. Because during an inflationary environment, then companies get pricing power back. So that's particularly true at the beginning of a new inflationary cycle. Because interest rates have not risen yet, and spending is continuing to trend higher. And that's exactly what we have right now. And we also have this environment where consumers are flush with cash. And we know that they're flush with cash because they're not delinquent on their credit cards. Because when people are under financial duress, well, then they're going to go for putting some of the burden on their credit cards. So the 30-year, or excuse me, the 30-day delinquency data goes back to 2002, and it's been trending lower since 2009, and then it trended lower faster in 2020. So we can, I think it's reasonable to conclude that it would be really hard to argue that consumers are under any kind of duress until the credit card delinquency rates start to break higher. So they were a little stronger, or I guess it really means weaker, but the number was up in September. But we still have the lower highs. So until the process of lower highs is broken, well then there is not much cause for worrying about the health of the consumer. And since Wall Street is mostly consumer, then that should continue to be reasonably benign. Then we can also think about the high yield spreads. So high yield spreads continue to remain practically inert, and that suggests that there's no real duress on the corporate sector. So we might have bond yields that are rising and inflationary pressures that are rising, but the stock market has been a stalwart in that environment. And a good part of the reason for that is because consumers and companies are still doing well. And they're benefiting from the higher price environment because companies get to raise prices. And because wages are also rising, then consumers don't quite feel the rising cost of living, but instead look more at their pocketbooks and how much more money they're making. Now, eventually that will stop, and prices will accelerate faster than wage growth, and people will find that their standard of living is deteriorating even though their wages are rising. Well, then that's when the stock market starts to underperform, and it's at that point that interest rate hikes really do start to bite. And we can also monitor that with the yield curve spread. So the yield curve spread has been quite inert over the course of the last few months. So let's just zoom in and look at it on a weekly basis. So we had the big trend higher all the way through 2020, got up to 160 basis points. We're currently holding around 120. And as long as this remains the case, well, then we're going to be in a reasonably benign environment. If we had to see the yield curve spread get all the way back to the 300 or 250 basis point level, that has generally coincided with significant market lows, well, that would mean that the 10-year yield would have to be more than 2.5% higher than the 2-year. And that's a big move from where we are right now, and it would have a significant knock-on effect. But there's the real possibility that the yield curve spread has peaked, and that we're in fact going to see that short-term rates start to back up, and that they will rise faster than longer-term rates, in which case we are going to have an inverted yield curve at some point in the future. But this falling yield curve has generally been coincident with a benign environment for stocks. So when we think about the outlook for the stock market, well, we are presented with consistent trends overall. And the Nasdaq has bounced pretty emphatically from the region of the trend mean. Now, I don't think there's anyone arguing that this is a steep trend, but the trend is consistent. As long as that remains the case, well, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. We're also seeing that an increasing number of global markets are breaking on the upside. So the Euro Stoxx Index has bounced from the region of the trend mean. It's holding this 450 area, and it looks like a break up and out of what is an extraordinarily long range. When we think about the FTSE 250, well, it's also bouncing here from the region of the trend mean. Then if we think about growth and inflation, well, emerging markets generally have more experience dealing with inflation. And India in particular, it might be overbought in the short term. And it's certainly susceptible to occasional bouts of volatility. But the reality is that it's growing, and it's likely to be one of the fastest growing countries in the world this year and potentially next. And the rising energy price hasn't really taken a tax out of the stock market just yet, and the banking sector is starting to perform better. And there's the real possibility that we're in a new credit cycle overall. So there's going to be more demand for credit, and that will be used to build infrastructure, to build factories, to build roads and ports. And companies are going to be able to source that money from the banking sector, and that is likely to contribute to significant growth over the course of the next few years. So there's the real possibility that India is going to be one of the growth leaders over the course of the next decade. The challenge for China is that they're trying their best to pop their property bubble. The CSI 300 remains reasonably steady. It's right in the region of the sequence of lower rally highs and the trend mean, and potentially has the scope to pop on the, excuse me, pop on the upside in here. China Evergrande made a bond payment in here today, so they avoided technical default by about 48 hours. They've got two additional bond payments for other bonds that are they're late on over the course of the next 10 days. So the risk of default hasn't been avoided, but what we are seeing is greater efforts to try and insulate the wider market from the collapse of China Evergrande, of Fantasia, and a number of other smaller property developers. The CSI 300 Real Estate Index, which includes China Vanke, which is the biggest of the property developers, it's firming from the lower side of the 6-year range. And it's testing the sequence of lower rally highs, or and well, sorry, it's broken that, and testing the region of the 200-day moving average. So this is at least some evidence of support coming through. And when China talks about getting control of the situation, well, what they're really talking about is that the investment-grade bonds haven't moved at all. But the high yield bonds are the ones that have pulled back and clearly broken the uptrend. So it's in the high yield sector where the risk is sitting in China. But China is in this rather difficult situation. They don't want to impose a property tax because they know it would be incredibly unpopular. Nobody likes paying taxes on property. And it's one of the most effective revenue-raising measures, so most countries have one, and China doesn't. So that has pretty much robbed regional and municipal governments of revenue, and they are not given enough revenue from the central government. And the government then also has the question of how do they source the funds that they need, because land sales and the cozy relationship between local governments and property developers have been the go-to way to source funding. And if the property sector isn't going to be allowed to do that, well, then the central government is going to have to send more money. And they don't want to do that either, because it would mean tightening up on tax collection. So, obviously, that's not going to be particularly popular either. And all of this is happening a year ahead of Xi Jinping securing himself another 5-year term and extending his rule for potentially indefinitely. So China has big questions to ask, but certainly what they're trying to do is to reduce the weighting of property in the wider economy. But if that is going to contract, well, then the question is, what's going to take its place? So Alibaba continues to bounce. But I thought what was particularly interesting this week was that they released their own design for a cloud computing chip. And that's being viewed as a significant evolution for the company. But what it also helps to highlight is that Alibaba is now doing what it's told. And what the government wants is less focus on social media and more focus on hardware and on the tools that will be necessary to achieve Chinese semiconductor independence. So, a much greater emphasis in the domestic economy on both production and design of chips is likely to be a central focus. So certainly that news from Alibaba means that they're toeing the line and doing what they're told, and that's obviously helping to support the share, and it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it's unwinding the short-term overbought condition, oversold condition, excuse me, relative to the trend mean. Then Tencent is also rebounding and attempting at least to unwind the oversold condition relative to the trend mean as well. So China is unlikely to represent the growth engine of the global economy over the next few years. They've got a lengthy process of consolidation underway, and there will be isolated incidences of clear outperformance, but the growth in the economy is likely to be less effective. And they're going to invest heavily in energy independence. So that also means significant demand growth for copper and also for uranium. Now, when we then think about the inflation overall, well, the big question is whether it's going to be temporary or not. And a lot of people have said that the inflation that we're getting right now is nothing like it was in the 1970s. And I would certainly agree with that, because the inflation that we had in the second half of the 1970s was the coming towards the end of the cycle. The seeds were sown for that cycle in the 1960s. And I do think that there are strong parallels today with what we had in the 1960s, because there were highly publicized assassinations. There was the real fear that there were good, that student protests would transform into protest movements and revolutions. And there was a massive social justice movement. And there was a lot of calls for outsized spending and monetizing fiscal deficits. And we're getting a lot of that right now. But the big question, and one of the reasons why gold has not been surging higher, is that the Democrats in the USA have not so far been successful in agreeing to a big spending package. They have a lot of support from the base, but they don't have the votes to push through the billions and, well, that's an understatement, trillions in spending. So then the question is, how will they be able to get that spending through, and what will it in fact be? So bond yields continue to rise, and that's pricing in the potential that inflation is starting to get out of control, that people want more. They want more money, they want better benefits, and they want it now. And they're going to continue to vote until they get what they want. And this is eerily similar to what we had in the 1960s and the early 1970s. And I remember my mother talking about when they bought their first house. They were able to get a fixed rate mortgage, which did not exist when she was telling me the story in Ireland. And that preserved their purchasing power for years afterwards, despite inflation taking off in the late 1970s because they had a fixed rate mortgage. Their mortgage was the least of their worries. And then, on top of that, because of the massive spending, she would never vote for the party that had put through all the spending, because she felt like they had betrayed her, because she would end up having to pay off all that debt for years to come. So that's the way that things are going right now, because there is a clear movement underway to build more houses, to provide people with access to cheaper housing, to provide them with a better standard of living and more money, less taxes, more benefits. And there's not a lot of thought going into how it's all going to be paid for. And ultimately, the answer is going to be through inflation. So we're at the beginning of the inflationary cycle, and we're not at the end of it. And when we're at the end of it, well, then we're going to see bond yields substantially above where they are right now, and we're going to be in a more taut political environment globally because there'll be a race to the bottom in terms of the purchasing power of fiat currencies. So we're really only at the beginning of that trend now. And a lot of the policies that are being put in place today are directly inflationary. Whether that is to raise wages, whether it is because of climate rules to constrain production of everything, or whether it is an inhibition of the farming community to continue to increase production, whether that is also going to lead to higher taxes on carbon, then I think the other big bottleneck that we have is there is this question about support for unions. Because when we think about the rights of workers and I guess the risks taken by capitalists and the weighting of labor to capital within the economy, there's very little attention paid to the relative power of unions. So everybody knows that teachers' unions tend to be powerful, and they occupy a very important place within the economy. And because of that place that they occupy, they get to negotiate for the kinds of things that the union finds important. So often that doesn't mean higher wages for teachers, and but it does mean that it's difficult to get rid of a teacher. Whereas when we think about the global supply chain, I don't think anyone was really fully cognizant of just how powerful longshoremen can be when they earn salaries of several $100,000 for what is effectively not a particularly difficult job, and they have no incentive to increase throughput through ports. So that has slowed everything down to a crawl because they haven't been, and it was a common practice, and I'm sure it's still underway, but in 2020, when a member of a shift in the port in Los Angeles came down with COVID, they put the whole shift on furlough, and nobody was tested until everybody felt fine, and then the shift came back. And because it's a heavily unionized and an extremely well-paid job, then they have a disincentive to hire more people. Which means then that you had this incredible slowdown in the ports. So we're still living with that, and that union is still in place, and that bottleneck is going to take time. We've had certainly companies like Walmart and Target and Samsung, they've commissioned their own containers. They've even hired their own ships. But they're going to pay to have their ships unloaded at night. But they're not going to be unloading anybody else's ships. So when we talked to logistics people that we've got relationships with in China, they were very doubtful that there was going to be any real change at the ports, that there would be isolated incidences of companies like Walmart and Target that gain a competitive advantage. So they're going to be the companies that do have inventory when it comes to this holiday season. And there's going to be difficulty for other companies that haven't invested in this additional premium on transportation costs. Because the cost of moving a container from China to the USA is up from about 3,000 to 20 to 30,000, and the Baltic Dry Index, it might have paused a little over the course of the last couple of weeks, But that's been an awfully big breakout. So the price is down now to 4,600, and I don't think anyone's going to be worried about the consistency of the advance unless it is pulling back below the trend mean overall. So these kinds of bottlenecks, they're going to be difficult to iron out. And one of the easy ways to iron them out would be to throw some of the environmental regulations out the window and to unconstrain the oil and gas sector to drill and mine as much as possible. But it doesn't look likely. So we're going to still be in this environment where we have a dearth of workers. And it's unlikely that the millions of people that are outside of the workforce are going to come back until credit card delinquencies start to rise. Because the vast majority of people don't like working, and they only work because of necessity. And it would be rising credit card delinquencies would be something that would force people to come back to work, because they would rather work than welch on their debts. So that suggests that it's going to be an interesting thing to pay attention to, because inflationary pressures are certainly rising. And there is then, of course, the clear risk overall that governments are going to be unable to raise interest rates. We have Jay Powell again talking today and saying that he believes it's time to taper. And when President Trump's, former President Trump's SPAC goes up 1,200% in the space of 48 hours, well, then I think anybody can conclude that we're in a frothy environment. So yields are at extraordinarily low levels, and the quantity of debt overall has multiplied. And the cost of servicing that debt becomes a crushing burden if we start to see yields multiplying from here. And if the yield were to multiply to go from 1.2 to 2.4, well, 2.4 would only get us back to where the yield was at its peak in 2011 or back in 2019. And in that time, the quantity of debt outstanding has multiplied. So we're in an environment where central banks are going to have an extraordinarily difficult time raising rates. And they're starting to worry about frothy markets. But if we're really thinking about frothy markets, well, then the only way that you can deter that froth is to raise interest rates and to withdraw liquidity. But they're also going to try and protect their precious recovery because they've spent so much money on achieving it already. So it is likely that we're going to see some tapering. And that tapering may even begin quite soon. And we might even see some pause and consolidation as investors digest all of this. But the defining characteristic of this bull market overall has been the willingness of investors to look through the bad news and conclude that we're just not going to see interest rates rise. So we've definitely seen that international stock markets are breaking up and out of long-term basis, and they trade at lower valuations. That's certainly true of Europe, it's true of Japan, it's true of the UK. They trade at lower valuations than the USA does. And ultimately, they have the potential to catch up. And we have these higher valuations in Wall Street, and not least because of the growth of the tech sector. Snap pulled back in an extraordinarily volatile manner in here today, and it weighed on Facebook and Google and Twitter. And the one company that it didn't bother at all was Apple, because it's all about Apple flexing its muscles in terms of their dominance of the App Store market. So Apple continues to bounce from the region of the trend mean, and this looks like the completion of a year-long consolidation. And as long as these large companies continue to trade above their respective trend means, well, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, and that this is a bubbly environment. We have plenty of evidence of froth, and we are in an environment where people don't care about earnings. And when there was, I continue to hear these stories about people encountering very young people splashing money around because they're making so much money in the crypto markets, and people that no longer work and are day trading. And I haven't heard those kinds of stories in 20 years. So again, this is evidence of frothy environments. But bubbles don't die on their own. They're assassinated by central banks. And that happens when they start to raise rates. And we're definitely seeing international central banks raising rates. And we're seeing that commodity-related currencies are beginning to steady. And the Australian dollar has been quite volatile, but it's holding the region of the trend mean right now. And it looks like a higher reaction low and support around the 70 cent level. The South African rand is also reasonably steady around this 14 area. So if we see a big move higher again in commodity prices, it will take these commodity related currencies with them. Brazil in particular is a bit of a standout right now because the standards of governance are deteriorating, and it is taking a lump out of the value of the currency. So the stock market has taken the brunt of selling pressure in the emerging markets recently. As we think though about where we are in this cycle, there is obviously a problem evolving in the bond markets because of this interest rate sensitivity. We have frothy environments in stocks, which is a direct response to low interest rates. So, to solve the problem in one will create a problem in the other. And that's the essence of a debt trap, and that's exactly where central banks find themselves. Which suggests that this bubble is not over and that we're still in the inflation phase because bubbles don't pop until liquidity becomes unavailable and they continue to be fueled by additional liquidity. So India's in a new credit cycle. Eventually, China is going to have to do something to print more money, and I continue to think that we're at the bottom of the credit impulse in China, so it's only going to get better from here. And then eventually the US government is going to come through with additional spending in China. Obviously there are these problems, but in Europe you have a new German government, you have stresses with Poland, and there's likely to be less respect for fiscal austerity and more spending overall, and not least to achieve the ambitions of the climate lobby. So that's a lot of liquidity floating around looking for a home. And we're only at the beginning of the tapering process. And the yield curve spread, it has quite likely hit its peak. And if that's the case, then ultimately we should see it starting to trend lower. And again, it's been a wonderful lead indicator for future recessions when it becomes inverted. And we're an awfully long way from inversion, which suggests at least that the hedges against inflation will become more popular. Gold is the ultimate hedge against inflation. Stocks are a hedge against inflation at the beginning of the cycle, which is exactly what we have right now. And the jury's really out on whether Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation, because Bitcoin has never existed in a high interest rate environment, and it's liquidity fueled. So that to me at least suggests that it is not going to be a hedge against inflation, but it's certainly a risk asset, and it's one of the better performing risk assets, and therefore it's likely to should be, I think, viewed as a risk asset. And I think with that, I will leave you for this week, and I wish all the best to all of you.